I just love that idea of this idyllic, you know, campus that you can walk end to end in 25 minutes. It just kind of, like you said, it's almost an emotional response for me when I got there, and I think for a lot of people that attend.
Thanks for joining the Beyond High Street Pod, where we'll journey with Miami alum, now business execs, entrepreneurs, community leaders, pro athletes, actors, musicians, and much more, digging into their experiences on campus and how that time and learnings help shape and create their diverse professional careers. Today, we'll journey all the way back with a dear friend, Jay Livingston, who was the first person I met on campus during Miami orientation, dare I say, almost 30 years ago. He's an angel investor, a CMO at a high-flying pet retail and e-commerce business, and he credits a ton of this back to his days on the concert board on campus. It's June 1990. I'm going back to Miami, or I'm going to Miami for the first time for orientation. I've got a next door neighbor here. I open the door and boom, Jay Livingston. What do you remember about that?
I remember us being at freshman orientation I was with Kevin Kreisel, a good friend growing up from Knoxville, Tennessee. We were both looking around like, what are we doing here in the Midwest at this school at Miami? And you and Chris Cordial were the first two guys we ran into at orientation. And I remember us hanging through those couple of days and then staying friends ever since.
27 years.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? And it's been fun to kind of watch all the progression, of course, during that time. But it's also just such a fun story. Like, we hadn't even gotten to the start of school yet, so orientation was really where this one began.
All right, so let's go back to Oxford for a second. Freshman dorm, where was it?
Dodds Hall.
And then after Dodds Hall, a couple years in the fraternity house, or the rest of the time in the fraternity house?
Yeah, I was SAE. I was in the annex, which was an annex house of the fraternity, right behind the fraternity house. And then junior year, the fraternity house. And then senior year, one of those classic Miami house names that you probably shouldn't say, called Blue Balls, which was always funny to hear your grandmother say, like, you know, how's the blue ball? And so was kind of in that housing system the whole time.
And why did you and Kevin, what brought you to Oxford from Tennessee?
You know, a decent amount of kids went from Knoxville and Nashville to Miami, and it was about 4 hours away, which was that good length that felt like you were away from home, but it was also close enough that you could get back for weekends and holidays. It felt like a different part of the country, and both of us had looked at a bunch of different schools, and it just kind of felt like home when we saw it. The Greek system and the beautiful campus. We liked the people. It was just a good combination of a lot of factors.
I felt the same thing coming from Maryland. Just it was close enough to home, but it was far enough to be away, and walked on campus and fell in love with that place.
Yeah, I loved the town. I loved the small town atmosphere and a real college town. I really wanted that. You know, in Knoxville, the University of Tennessee is there where my parents both went. But it's kind of integrated with the city. And so I just love that idea of this idyllic, you know, campus that you can walk end to end in 25 minutes. And it just kind of, like you said, it's almost an emotional response for me when I got there. And I think for a lot of people that attend.
Every time we have one of these conversations that we talk about business and CEOs and chief marketing officers, I'm always interested in actually back in college what their major was, because often they're not coming from the business school. What was your major in college?
So I was speech communications, which I don't think they have anymore, but it was sort of an organizational communications major with a minor in political science. The beauty of that major was, though, it was a very open-ended major that gave me a lot of flexibility to take a bunch of other classes, and I wanted a liberal arts degree, but I took a ton of business classes. I mean, I think north of 20 or 25 hours worth of business classes, which was such a great compliment, right? Because I love the interpersonal relations and the public speaking and all of the studies that we did within communications. You know, I really learned a lot about, I had a great professor, Dr. Nadler, who was one of the foremost researchers in sort of communication patterns. And so really got to embed deep in that kind of research type of approach to how people communicate, but also get a lot of those good hardcore marketing, finance, and economics classes.
And your world now, you take that 25 years later, it's chief marketing officer of Bark. bark to someone that has a dog or a pet. They live it every day. But if you don't, people aren't familiar with the brand, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a brand that a lot of dog people know about, and obviously we want more and more people to know about over time, but it's still somewhat unknown outside of our circle, although we have a massive social media audience. So if you take all the other, basically the engagement of all the other pet brands in the United States and combine them by eight, we still have more engagement with our social media audience. So that has really propelled a lot of folks knowing a good bit about Bark and BarkBox.
And what is it about Bark or BarkBox that has that social media engagement?
I think they started out with no real goal in mind other than entertaining content by crazy dog people. And, you know, we weren't necessarily trying to sell anything through the social media. We just tried to use a lot of great content out there. We have some really smart folks and a lot of really funny people doing a lot of that content. And it just kind of caught fire. And the beauty of it, of course, also is it's dogs, right? And so it's a natural fit for that. But you can really feel the authenticity of what passion there is for dogs through our channels. And it just kind of grew from there.
You always hear advertisers or creative directors at advertising agencies say, is there a baby or is there a dog? We need one of those two in the ad.
I used to joke at Bank of America. My boss one time said, Jay, you got to go easy on the babies and dogs in the ads. And I was like, hey, they work, you know? And so I got to Bark, and after about a month, I've been here, I said, listen, we need more babies. Like, I got to add, we're missing out on that component of it. So, yeah, you're right. It just, you know, those things pull at the heartstrings. And as we know, you know, great marketing creates an emotional connection and those things. Puppies and babies do that really well.
And so give us a little bit more of the model of Bark. You are a little bit in retail, mostly direct to consumer, a monthly subscription?
Yeah, we're really divided into three businesses. We're best known for BarkBox, which is our subscription box, a monthly themed box of toys and treats, all of which we make. And we have about 600,000 subscribers to the box. And then we recently rolled out in retail. We're in Targets nationwide, all 1,800. We have the end caps selling toys and treats there. And then we also have an e-commerce site where we sell a lot of, you know, dog products, toys, treats, and other dog stuff, basically.
1,800 Target outlets, 600,000 subscribers, probably a pretty good base to grow a business.
Yeah, we have about 94% retention rate on the box, which makes it quite an attractive business and very unusual in the subscription space.
That's an unbelievable number. I laugh because I think of when Mark Cuban or Kevin O'Leary or somebody at Shark Tank is asking an entrepreneur their retention rate, and they look sheepishly back at them and say, I don't know, about 2% or 5%. 94% is an unbelievable number.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the killer app on this product, which is so unlike any other subscription product, is after the third box, the dog knows what it is. And unlike humans, you know, they don't get tired of the box. So many other subscription businesses, after you get this thing for a few months, the excitement of that really wears off. But to the dog, the 100th box is just as exciting as the third box. And so that moment that's created, you know, every month where kind of dog parents are connecting with their dog, it never goes away. And so it actually changes the relationship dogs have with the postman, which we play on some, which is they start to think every box is a Bark box and they get super excited when they show up. But they can particularly pick out the Bark box when it comes. And you know, that's a really attractive, obviously, component to the whole experience.
That puts a little pressure on your R&D and research and development group to make sure that what's in those boxes stay fresh for these dogs every time, and the packaging too.
Well, you know, we have a ton of really innovative folks designing all that, including the head product designer at Lego and lots of those people that are constantly thinking every month, you know, what are just crazy themes that we can come up with that are super engaging and topical. And so it's a constant effort to come up with creative stuff for that.
There probably are not many guys, women out there that are the CMO of a pet e-commerce, retail, possibly food business that also spent 25 years at Bank of America.
Wasn't quite 25.
Now, 20 plus. But how about that transition? Two totally different looking companies.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. So I was recruited actually out of Miami to Nations Bank at the time, who later acquired Bank of America and about 400 other companies. And it's a great experience. I loved my career at Bank of America, and I really rotated around to every functional area of marketing and strategy at the company, which was such a great foundation to basically learn, then going to a smaller company that is trying to build those different basically channels and capabilities. And so it's funny, I basically, towards the end of my career at Bank, I was coming up on this thing called the Rule of 60, which is your age plus years of service, where you can retire actually when you lead the company at that. And so when I hit 40, I basically reached that milestone and told them about a year out that I was going to leave. One of the things that had happened is I'd gotten so far away from like the core customer and just a lot of on the ground marketing that I kind of missed that. And at the same time, I was doing a lot of angel investing in New York with a lot of, I have a lot of friends here who are founders and entrepreneurs. And as I was sort of advising some of those companies on the side just for fun, I realized, wow, man, the passion they're bringing to this and the energy here, I kind of miss. And so my thinking was, you know, I would take some time off. I'd started 3 weeks out of Miami and not had more than 2 weeks vacation in a row in 20 years. So I had all these projects I wanted to do. I wanted to renovate an old loft in the West Village here in New York. I wanted to restore a muscle car. I wanted to travel, learn to play guitar, spend some time with family. But then I kept the investing and advising up. And I thought, you know, I'd love to be a CMO of one of these companies that was really on the rise. And that's kind of what attracted me into the role.
What's it like to be an angel investor or an advisor to a startup business? And kind of your role in that, and what excites you in that space?
One thing is, it's just great to see all these different companies. So what happened was, a lot of the businesses in New York, a lot of the startups were founded by people with tech or finance backgrounds, right? And so, but if they're consumer facing, so many of them become marketing focused companies, whether they like it or not, within 6 months, because they've got to grow their subscriber base. Some of my first friends in New York, a huge group of guys that's been and women that have been super, super helpful to me, started asking me to say, hey, you know, could you advise us a little bit on marketing? And there weren't a lot of people, for whatever reason, in that space giving marketing expertise out there, growing customer bases. How do we treat the customers? What do we need to think about? And so as I saw some of these startups, I thought, you know, I'm happy to advise, but I also like the idea of investing in them. I've been investing my whole life, and it seemed like a logical next step. So the more word gets out, the more people send companies to you to take a look at or to talk to. And so, you know, I probably see a pitch deck once a week for the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, and I probably talk to 115 companies. I made investments in about 13. So, you know, and I'll typically go in often with some other friends or VCs that I know in town. And it's just a great way to see a lot of different businesses in this exciting space. And I've learned a lot just by kind of being in that ecosystem.
Yeah, what is that? What is the learning? We see it a lot, obviously, at Octagon, just from the talent that the company manages, as well as the brands that we're in and around sports and entertainment, the deal flow and understanding technology or where the market's moving. Is that a little bit of what you're seeing and helps too with Bark now?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, everybody comes in investing their own way. One thing I think's been, you mentioned Shark Tank, I think. Shark Tank has really shown a lot of the country in a very popular way how this type of investing works. And of course, it's a TV version of it, right? But at its core, foundationally, that's sort of how it works. I come at investing very much from the standpoint of, what is it about this product or service that, what have customers told you they want from this? So in other words, what is the real need there? What problem are you solving? And sometimes the answer is, we've got good data that shows this is a gap. This is something people want, which is great. Sometimes they say, I just think it's something that they want, and that requires a higher bar for me to make an investment or for us to make an investment in. But I'm really looking for something that says, you know, there's a gap in the market and people really want this thing that you've come up with.
Yeah, we here call it the customer pain point. What is it? We got to solve that before you can create a product or a service. That's for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
You mentioned earlier when we went back from BARC to Bank of America and you started with Nations Bank, and you said you were recruited out of Miami. So were you the traditional, went to the career fair, had internships, worked your way that way, or how were you recruited out of Miami?
Well, there are two things that the smartest thing I ever did was I got involved in a bunch of campus organizations. So I was on MUSEF, and then I was joined Concert Board my freshman year, ended up being chair of Concert Board. And so at the time, I think it was one of two fully student-run and funded concert organizations in the United States. At campuses. And so we would actually bring in these bands. Again, I'm going to date myself a little here. So the Wet Sprocket, the Indigo Girls, Bill Cosby, interestingly, James Taylor, Barry Manilow, all for parents weekends, you know, the sort of bands of the moments. And we would handle the production and execution finance soup to nuts. So, you know, my junior and senior year, that was a big part of what I was doing at the school. And it gave me an incredible talking point when I would sit down in these interviews and they'd say, hey, you know, your grades are fine, your extra other stuff looks good, what else can you tell me? And I'd say, well, I've made the school $120,000 on and selling 70,000 seats this year on our concert board. And that just gave me a story that really separated me from a lot of folks. So I knew I wanted to be in marketing coming out of Miami, and there were sort of two options if you wanted to be a marketer at the time. You could move to New York City and go work for an ad agency for $17,000 a year, which seemed very daunting, or you could go to one of the consumer packaged goods companies that were interviewing on campus, like Procter & Gamble or Kraft or somewhere like that, and they basically sent you to some city somewhere to stock shelves for a couple years before you go back to business school. Neither of those sounded that exciting. The banks actually were interviewing, and they had these great programs where they would rotate you around through technology and finance and other areas of the company. And after 3 years, you jump out of that program and go back to business school. So my thinking was, hey, I've already got a sense for marketing. I'm going to go get super well-rounded in these areas that I don't have a lot of experience or maybe even natural talent in. I'll go to business school, and then I'll come out and join one of these like CPG companies and go about it that way. So then what happened is I joined the bank. I started rotating around through the company through product management, process reengineering, through our M&A group. And before you knew it, we started buying all these other companies, and the place just became a rocket ship. So I placed onto the merger team for Boatman's Bank, which was a big bank in St. Louis, worked under the head of our brand marketing team there. And basically, they asked me to stay on afterwards. And so I placed into marketing full time. And before I knew it, you know, I was managing people and had a bigger team. Going to business school didn't seem like such a good idea. And it just kind of went from there.
Do you run into Miami students, friends, colleagues, people older, younger, kind of daily basis? I'm amazed every day out in the market, clients, possible clients, connections of Miami alum.
All the time. I sent an email to a girl that I met at the Cradle Marketers event where we speak, Kate Pratt, just this morning. I'm going to be at MSG next week and going to try to connect with her there. Several of my good friends are either Miami folks here in New York or, you know, our connections through them. So, yeah, it's amazing how long and far that network travels.
And I think because, and you talked about it earlier, of just being part of that small town, the culture, once you're a Miami student alum, hardcore network's the wrong word, but there's a trust factor, there's a respect factor. I think that's helped quite a bit, and it's fun to network, you know, continually.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think everybody gets the benefit. That's the beauty of these types of organizations, right? But your university is probably the most powerful one you'll ever be a part of, because that network disperses and people with lots of different backgrounds that you wouldn't necessarily get to take advantage of. I mean, occasionally, you know, you meet these people that don't really have many relationships from college or school, and I think that's fine, but I've gotten so much joy and joy and just additional like benefit of having that network from college. And so it's a shame, it seems to me, not to take advantage of it. Miami has a great one.
Yeah, I feel like that's a miss if somebody walks out of 4 years of school without the network. Not just friends or fraternity, sorority, but intramurals and clubs and professors I think in this connected world we live every day, and maybe a little harder when we started, but now when you leave school, you're connected to probably a couple thousand people just via your social channels or LinkedIn or other places like that.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's funny, when I left school, I came back 2 years later and I talked to a group. Three fundamental changes happened right after we left college, that any one of which would be a massive change in the way humans communicate. And those three things that came right at the point of when we left, right, which was the cell phone, email, and then the internet. Basically, 3 years after we left, everybody had all those things. And I remember going back and they said, well, when you had a party, what would you do? How would you let people know? And I said, we nail signs on trees, right? That's the way you told people that you were having something. And it's amazing to see how quickly that change happened, but how they can take advantage of that, those networks in a way that we really couldn't right when we got out of school. So I'm kind of jealous of that, frankly.
There was the beauty of not having that too, right? Just going uptown and going to a restaurant or a bar, and if your network wasn't there, well, you just left and went to the next.
Right. That's what you did, usually. You kind of, the whole night was chasing people around, asking people, have you seen so-and-so? And they'd say, yeah, I just saw them at Skipper's. They're up there, and you go to Skipper's, like, oh, they just left. They went to Top Deck, you know? And so it was like one of those kind of things. And a lot of times you didn't see them. And so you just made do with something else.
So for the Miami student now, we talked about, you know, if you can be involved in some of these organizations like MUSEF and Concert Board and taking advantage of networking, is there a class to take or anything else, a lesson that somebody, when you leave Oxford, you should have or know or have done?
I don't know. You know, I think the next way people can do that often is obviously thinking about the choice they make with the companies they go to, because a lot of people build relationships for life with those early companies. And of course, also business school or grad school. If there's anything I miss about not having gone to business school, I frankly don't think it would have helped me career-wise much, or, you know, the education would have been fun, I think, but I think I got plenty otherwise. But that network that you gain in business school, that's really the biggest thing. I mean, a lot of my friends that went to really top business schools have maintained those networks through the years. So those are certainly places. I gained a lot through our fraternity. I mean, it's become like an unpopular thing to say in a certain way, but I'm still close with tremendous amounts of my fraternity brothers. You know, we lived together for 4 years. We had just unbelievable experiences. That's something that you also can't replicate. And it's a shame that the fraternity experience has been had some of the issues that it's had and seems to be kind of under attack by a lot of the schools across the country.
Yeah, and it's not just your own fraternity. It's the system itself, too. I think, obviously, you and I were in rival fraternities 50 yards down the street from each other, but first person met on campus and still doing this 27 years later, too.
Yeah, plus, when our fraternities had a brawl, it was nice to have somebody in the other one that we could stand on the side and talk to for a minute. I seem to recall one of those with us.
All right, let's close with this. Talk about the attire difference from walking in Manhattan at Bank of America and what happens when you walk into BARC every day.
Wow. Well, I don't have the wardrobe for this company, I can tell you that. I had to change the wardrobe completely, as you can imagine. And it's so funny how everybody regards the other areas with suspicion. Wardrobe becomes part of sort of the cultural, you know, the cultural touchstone of it. It sort of signifies who you are and what you think about things. And in Lower Manhattan, working for a startup, you know, it's jeans and t-shirts. I think when I tuck a shirt in and have a collar, I'm regarded, I think, with a little more suspicion here. And so I've had to kind of think about that and adjust the wardrobe a little. So that has definitely been a big difference.
Yeah, if you're in the sports and entertainment world here and you have a coat and a tie on, it's not normally a good sign. You're interviewing or you're in trouble.
Yeah, I know. I mean, when somebody walks in with a tie here, it's just like, who is this person? Like, they're obviously a banker coming in to talk to us or something.
Jay's wisdom to separate himself from others during the interview process are great lessons for Miami students. I really appreciate his time and all of you for listening to Beyond High Street. See you at Skipper's.